integrating movement into one's appreciation and encouragement of awareness is essential. I think the traditional ways that this particular style of practice, the Theravadin tradition, does it in walking doesn't quite embody it totally. It's more like I'm aware up here that my body is walking where it's walking, but to incorporate the whole of the body within awareness. If you've ever seen a master of Qigong or Tai Chi, and you just see them, you'd know it. You just know that their body is being enveloped in awareness. You just feel it in it. And I'd encourage you, if you have that yearning to embody it, to practice one of those more Chinese traditions of Qigong or Tai Chi. Even yoga doesn't quite master what I'm talking about. Yoga, as I've understood it, in the ancient Hindu times, were expressions of what the body does as the energy systems within them, within the energy systems of the body move in a certain way. The yoga postures come out of that energies, those energies as they're rising. And so they're often a manifestation of the meditations themselves. But I just think that Qigong and Tai Chi in particular have a different completion of that embodied awareness. So anyway, that's my take. So I would like to start off this afternoon with a little more on the growing up phase of things. I feel like I slighted it a little bit. And growing up is the stabilizing component. Growing up really means in every way psychological maturity as well as spiritual steadiness. So it's the steadiness of mind and heart. And many of us never grow up. And those of us who intend ourselves in that direction frequently don't grow up completely because we have bits of ourselves that we have in reserve that we don't want to share even with ourselves. And those are usually our self-assumptions, those parts of ourselves that we feel hold us to such self-definition that we're afraid to express them, although we overcompensate for them almost endlessly. And so if we have a particular self-definition, and by that I mean something that was trained in us very early on, so for instance it could be, there's something wrong with me, or I am not but adequate, or whatever it might be. It's usually induced or has been induced through our childhood. But if you think about it, as a child before the childhood, before you were had allowed that induction to take place, you weren't like that. You weren't a horrible person, as the mind has translated other people's behavior towards you as being, I am a bad person, or whatever it might be that you've assumed. And yet we've held that because the input from parents or significant others over time, or we've just interpreted life in that way, in that direction, and then we've held it and calcified it in us. And when that place is touched in us, it's on fire in terms of its pain. It really feels like if when that expression of oneself arises, that is the essence of me. That's what it feels like. Doesn't feel like a conditioned phenomenon, which is what it is. It feels like somebody has touched the essence of me because that was the first definition of ourselves that we knew because of early childhood training. And so when we back up our history, that inevitably will show up. And when it does, the emotional turbulence that arises from that definition becomes almost too much for anyone to bear. I'm saying this because I know it in myself. I've exposed myself to my own sense of self-assumptions. And they're fiery hot. They're like you've gone to the center of the furnace. And so there has to be some reason to even want to go there. And you have to see that your mind, that aspect of mind, is so troubling to interactions or to relationships or to being a husband or father or whatever it might be, the roles I take on, and perhaps most significantly to my spiritual development. Because those self-definitions, although they're not real, but we believe them to be real, and that's what makes them as real as they are, when we are exposed to them, everything else, all your spiritual relevance, all your spiritual higher phenomenon, your love and your amazement and your wonder and your love and all that, it crunches down into that fact that I'm not worth it. I'm not worthy of it. So it has to be dealt with. Believe me, I would have never touched it otherwise. That's an honest statement. But you have to go there, because the counterweight to that sort of self disregard, the counterweight is your heart. If that's sufficiently exposed over time, so that your heart, the inward yearning of your heart, the compelling nature of your heart, which, as we practice, continues to pull us outward from ourself. If the counterbalance of that is my self-assumptions, which pulls me back in, there's only one thing that can counterweight that, and that's that you give yourself over to your heart. You give yourself over to that which knows no limitations, no bounds, that is not, knows no definitions. And so the sense of the outward expansion of the heart that knows no definitions and the inward pain of what I know myself to be come in conflict with one another. And when that happens, either you quit practicing or you practice superficially. So listen to your own, where you are in that. Or you confront it and move beyond. And when we confront it and move beyond, that's the deeper aspect of growing up. And although it feels like you've been terrorized by your own history, it's only this much. It feels like it will be more, because what comes up in alignment with that, or in an accompaniment of that, are the traumas that induced it. Those are still in us. And so if you were an abused child, or even a severely punished child, or a critical child, or your teachers, or whatever it was, those incidences are also arising with the assumption. Those are what the assumptions are based on. The assumptions and the incidences may have been historically significant at one point, but now they're both in there, and one is sort of defines the reason I'm that way is because of all these things that occurred to me. And because I've continued to prove that assumption from then on. Because whenever we make a mistake, the first thing comes out is, oh, of course I made a mistake. I'm a mistake. See? So we keep reinforcing it years after the traumas that occurred that created the initial assumption have long since passed. And so we have to recorrect that. We have to recorrect the language. And I'm talking now about all the different disciplines that are available. Psychotherapy. You know, we sometimes in spiritual traditions, psychotherapy, that's for people who are involved in their mind. Hello! When you really take that on seriously, then you look at how much involvement we have with our minds, and you see why that's there, then if therapy can help, great. And for some of us who have almost genetically or chemically induced problems like depression or different psychological dramas, even traumas, you know, PTSD, all of those things. Medications which can balance out the chemistries make sense. Oh, I don't do that. Well, okay, don't. And how does that feel? You know, and so you just, whatever is helpful here, whatever is helpful, whatever, nothing's out of bounds here. And you're grabbing at everything to try to bring or uplift the mind out of its assumptions. One of the beauties of therapy, and I want to really credit therapy, is that it shows that your activity is not self-blamed. It shows you, in context of your living situation, that these forms of self-assumptions, these expressions of yourself, these beliefs, have come from outward sources. They've came from how my mother, this or that. And that's very important for your own freedom, to have a sense of someone else standing behind you or beside you, impartially showing you that it's not you, it's not just you. And that, because so much of it is densely in there as being all my fault. And so as this gets thinned, which seems to be the word of the day, as that begins to balance itself, and therapies also show us that it's all conditioning. You've been conditioned that way. I can show you a point in your history when you weren't like that. That wasn't latent in you that you grew into. It was induced in us through conditioning. Without that conditioning, you wouldn't have that assumption. Now, understanding that allows the Dharma student to say, okay, take it on. Let me see, if I've been conditioned, it can be extinguished. Okay, and just because I was a strong sense of self-belief and associated with that doesn't mean it can't be extinguished. It means it's going to be painful to be extinguished. Okay, so bring it on. And sometimes writing can be very helpful where it's the next step beyond therapy, because therapy doesn't usually lead to selflessness. So we can't stop with therapy usually. You have to move into the next depth of being. And the next depth beyond therapy is that self-exploration, that when we feel that pain generate, that I'm no good or something's wrong with me, what I did for a long time was to conjure up those situations in my mind that led to that feeling, and so the feeling was reactivated, and then start writing down everything that comes up. Okay? But don't add any new conditioning to what's coming up. So when it feels, oh, there's something wrong with me, there's always been something wrong with me, I'm a terrible person, that's coming up out of the experience, I don't say, and I'm still like that. That's adding a new layer of conditioning to the old layer. You see that? That's really important. That's what makes this a Dharma practice as opposed to therapy, or it also keeps you in line with the original instructions, which was to let a thought be a thought without adding anything to it, or an emotion be an emotion. So we're just letting this, because it's in the cells. We've lived with it for so long, in our cells are these assumptions. And as they start coming up and beginning to re-terrorize ourselves, this is where that centeredness becomes absolutely necessary. Where we are centered in our place, because without that, off we go back into the same historical patterns. Okay, so now we're centered, and we've activated this, and it starts arising. And it's helpful just to, I used to just walk back and forth screaming at what, this sounds crazy, and to anybody that besides myself it was, but it wasn't to me. You just start walking back and forth I hate myself, I can't stand myself, or whatever it is that your particular assumption contains, because all that is coming out of the past, not the present. The present, I wasn't going to add anything from the present to those assumptions. I wasn't going to do that. That's not Dharma. You see? And if you do that, it only lasts so much, so long. We're talking about months, not years. And now that assumption doesn't arise anymore. So what does that do dharmically? It allows something else to come in its place. If you're not self-assuming, then selflessness has a hole there that it can fill. As long as we're self-assuming, which we usually are, in every glance and every interaction, you have no hole. There's no thinning there for awareness to enter. Because we've assumed, we keep covering it over with self-assumptions, and awareness can't get through a self-assumption. How can it? Because it doesn't contain you. You see? And so, but many of us are not willing to go to that place. We're not, because of the pain that's on that level. Okay, so I'm not encouraging you to do that, but in the time when it feels appropriate, when you are curious about that, when you realize you can't move as long as this is in place, then you'll do it on your own. And you'll do whatever you need to put those assumptions in perspective. Whatever you need to. And then you can move on. And I've never heard it said exactly like that in other countries, and Thailand and Nepal and all the places I've journeyed, because I don't think other countries have this kind of induction that's in us. But it is Western, and so as a Western mind, I speak to you from Westernness. We can do this. You have to have a certain degree of confidence, things that I've already mentioned, courage, confidence, centeredness, and also I had to have practiced long enough to know that an emotion was an emotion, that a thought was a thought. And so all of those coming together led to the threshold of my being willing to take that on. And it was not easy, but as one person told me, I don't go there, it's too painful. When somebody says that to me, I back off completely, because it has to be in your own timing. It has to be in accordance to your own urge, because that's the heart's urge that wants to move beyond a limitation. And the heart will always want to move beyond a limitation when it owns the limitation, when it sees the limitation. And so the final phase of growing up, or another step of growing up, is to look deeply into those areas of ourself that ourself are emotionally regressed, that are stubbornly saying the same thing year after year after year after year. And if you get to that, go to every you use everything. This is where the Dharma comes in. Oftentimes when you feel like you can't do it, something comes in. The hand. Sistine Chapel. It's true. You go, oh, thank God. And so it does like that, because when you know, you just need the right person, and the right person is found, is discovered, or whatever it is, to help you move through. So don't think you're alone in this. You're not alone. Not alone in this. Metta can be very helpful, but metta during this time is a slight can be and often is a slight counter reaction to the pain of it. To get yourself out of pain, you do metta. And I didn't want to put anything there that made it easier. You know, I knew that I would have to deal with the rest of it at some point if I made it easier, so I just let me have it all at one time. This is like that commercial, I can't believe I ate the whole thing. So it's kind of like that. But metta in general is a thinning, a self-thinning. And the reason that metta often has this counter-reaction of your real self-belief, which is I'm unworthy, or it's all up to me, or I'm alone, or in isolation, whatever your assumption is because of that self-thinning. As the self thins through metta and love, what's left of yourself comes ripping through that on the other direction to pull you back into yourself. And so the most strongly conditioned part of ourselves is what interrupts metta. And so metta is, you know, you got to try to convince yourself that metta is, don't convince yourself, just say, well, I've got to deal with what's erupting into metta. It's the shadow of metta. Anytime you weigh in to the left, the shadow of the right is going to come in as well, the sun and the moon. So with all of this growing up, what's the point? I mean, if it's just a psychological well-being, fine, but it's not just psychological, because the end stage of all of that is the ability to free yourself from the mind so that the mind no longer defines anything. That's what's so amazing. At some point, it's the final strand is cut. It doesn't define anything. Emotions don't define anything. Thoughts are just like self-concepts, and ego is seen as a mind conjured up creation. All of it is just, in fact, you wonder how you ever believed in it. And so when then it does, because it does, it for the rest of our life, it will continue to do what conditioning does, which is present itself. And so unless we are have freed ourselves from the conditioning, then it's going to keep turning us around in that direction. But freedom is freedom of that. Freedom is freedom of the mentality of existence. And that's everything. And everything remains. That doesn't mean because you no longer have the pain of your childhood that you don't remember your childhood. Or you remember the cause of that pain. That stays. But it doesn't have the impact of it. Now, we're all aging in this room. That's a promise. And hopefully we'll continue to age. Aging does two things that work against each other. It presents conditioning after all the years you've lived, so it's hardened. But it also, to its benefit and yours, gives you a sense of, if I don't do it now, when am I going to do it? A sense of urgency. Don't worry about the former. Really, whether you've had 10 years of this conditioning or 50, it's still hot. And it does. I don't know, because I don't know what it's like to do this work at age 20, but I do know what it's like to do it at age 50, and the resolution to do it was much firmer over time. See, that people say, oh, the psychological, that's different than the spiritual. It's not the same thing. If we can't make everything the same, this is not wise teaching. Wise teaching is that everything has one essence. Not that the mind is over here and who cares about it. Well, you better care about it because you're carrying it with you, right? It's all of one essence. And as we begin to see through, as the mind continues to evoke its history, we see the translucence of its thoughts and emotions. And we see that it's, in essence, the same as the awareness that holds those thoughts. Now the circles come, what's that called? Anyway, I can't remember, but that. Enso? Yeah, Enso. That's growing up. Huh? Now there are no adults, so drop that one. It's growing up I'm talking about, which is a lifetime project. Lifetime. But then they're showing up. That's the next phase. Growing up, showing up, and waking up. I didn't think those up. I read them somewhere and then I added my own stuff to them. So if you said, well, he's just copying, I don't know, I'm not copying anything. I just took those names and thought, oh, that would make a nice weekend. So showing up. Well, growing up provides greater stability because we're not being rocked by each passing blow of self-contentiousness and all of that. It just allows the mind to come to more stability. Now, from that stability, I can ask questions. It's hard to ask questions when you're looking around every corner for some, afraid of some sense of judgment that's coming your way. But once we have stability of mind, then you can show up. And showing up is saying, okay, growing up said you're not as bad as you thought. You're actually okay. And based upon that stability of knowing or feeling one's self-esteem, I can now move to what showing up is. It's like what showing up is like you're landing on the earth for the first time and wondering what all this is about. What is all this? What's this? And you can do it not according to what the culture has said you have to do for your life to be lived well. All of that you have to slough off. And this is hard. This is another hard, but it's not like the pain of what I was just speaking about. This is going against cultural imperatives. You should be productive in life, you should be useful, you should be, all of the idealism that this culture imparts in us is very strongly there in terms of us evaluating what our life is and how well we're doing. Have I had children? Am I married? Am I this? Am I that? Which has nothing to do with anything except what the culture told you to keep itself going, you need to do. So you stand very straight in this and take it on and say, no, that's not what this life is about. In fact, then it takes you, that curiosity and interest drops you into a lower level of exploration. And so what is the essential meaning of life? Not is what culture tells me a meaningful life will have, enough money and enough this and enough that. But what is essentially a meaningful life? It's a very interesting question because I just got that question about a month ago. Well, it was actually December 13th. And there's a website called something like whatisthemeaningoflife.com or something like that. But it has 1,000 responses from people, some of them long since dead, like Carl Jung and Freud and Angelo de Mello and Saint Teresa and all of that, okay? So somehow they've looked at their teachings and pulled out what was meaningful, or I don't know. But anyway, you can read all that, that's fun. So after 1,000 of those responses, they got around to asking me, Rodney, what do you think the meaning of life is? It's good to have humility when you get that. Anyway, so I sent it off, and then I got interested in other people's responses to it because it is an important question, and they're good. It's a good website to read because not every one of them is inspiring, but many of them are. What is Tolstoy's? I mean, it's there. It's got all the. So anyway. So when I was reading, I thought, okay, so what is this? I said, well, okay, well the problem is in the question. See, this is where, when you're asking what is life, you've got to ask what is life. Not what is the meaning of life, but what is life itself. And most of us think of life as being divided. My existence is here, and I'm living the outward expression of life. So there's the outward expression of life, which is my actions and all of that, all of this. And then there's the inward expression of life, which is my section of that life. And so we've sectioned ourselves off. And I said, we're never going to come to the resolution of what is meaningful as long as we keep that sense of division. Because from the sense of the heart, it's divided. To it, as a divided expression of ourselves, it knows we're not divided. And so it keeps looking for the meaning of life as non-division. And we keep acting more divisively, answering the question with more division. Like if I have children, or if I have love, then I'll be meaningful. I will be meaningful if I have love. I will be meaningful. My life will be meaningful if I, which is just adding pieces to ourselves until we somehow get to the point where we feel meaningful or something, which I never have in that level of working. When I'm famous, when I'm 999th and not 1,000th on the list of... I'm waiting for 800. So first of all, we have to understand what life is. It's a non-divided. Existence isn't divisive. It's not divided. So why do I think it is? Maybe if I answered that question, then this whole question of meaning would answer itself. So what is it that makes me think I'm separate? There's two separate existences. There's the existence I'm witnessing and the existence I'm feeling I live. Well, the answer again is in the question. The existence I'm living and the existence I'm observing. The existence I'm living. Why isn't the existence I'm living, why doesn't it feel complete? Because the sense of observation itself, any time we observe something, we've made it distant. And so all of you are distant from me because you are an act of my perception. And my perception is based upon memory of having met you or this or that, and therefore distant from me, some relationship to me, but not a part of the existence I live. And so maybe the question isn't so much a question of finding a missing piece and bringing it in, but in re-perceiving the life I'm living. Don't let your eyes fuzz over here. Fog over. stay with me, because it's crucial. Now, if I just back away from the credibility I give my observation, because I realize that observing life is a conceptual thing. I observe and at the same time recognize my history within what I see. And because my history precedes this moment, that seems like a conceptual gap between what I perceive, the person I know and how I've known them and who I know them to be, and the person who's observing. And all of that is mental coverage, layering. And so what does life look like when I just release the need to conceptualize life? That's really what it comes down to. Because I see that conceptualized life is, there's a space in which the thoughts about what I'm seeing come in, and that feels distant to the existence I'm living. Is anybody getting this? Okay. So what does non-conceptual life look like? That's just a question. You see, but this is inquiry. This is what dyads, which we will have shortly, this is where it takes you, us. You start wondering, but you're curious. You're not wondering in fear, oh God, I can't go there, then what? No, it's like, whoa, because the heart is full of wonder, fear, full of curiosity. And once it's allowed to have its own voice in my spiritual journey, it comes out with the biggest questions. What's life look like when I shut up? Huh? So how do I shut up? I'm continually talking to myself. I believe that jabber. How do I show up? Feel it. Pre-thought, prior to thought, is the silence from which thought arises. When you ask that question, you go pre-thought. Because you're not interested in the thought, because you saw the thought was the problem to begin with. It was the conceptualization that I believed seeing through thought that allowed me to even ask this question. So now I'm not going to ask that. I'm not going with thought anymore. But you see, we've realized that now. That's not some kind of psychological or theoretical or intellectual curiosity. It is a direct experience. Oh my God, there's only one existence. The question of meaning has no meaning. This is amazing. And it's that close. But I had to go through labor pains to get here. That's why it's always depicted as Star Wars, you know, the mythological evil and good, because the worst things we think about come to fruition before we can get to stillness. Now where are you going? Where are you going now? You see? Okay.